From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Michael Kazin knows why Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is getting big crowds as he campaigns for president across the country. He says it's his unvarnished, class-conscious message about economic equality. Kazin knows Sanders' chances of getting the Democratic nomination, let alone becoming president, are slim, but he says the message has worked in this country, even though a socialist hasn't gotten very far in American politics. Think about fair wages and women's suffrage and safe working conditions. These are all issues socialists raised and fought for. Today in the program, we're talking about socialism, how it works, what it means. We'll talk about the contribution it's already made to American life, and we'll ask this question: aren't we already kind of socialist anyway? After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing socialism. Conservatives have been pretty good over the decades of making the word socialism seem radical or decrepit or outdated as a mechanism for governing people. But it turns out the history of socialism is pretty vibrant and actually kind of successful. Even though we've never elected a socialist as president, we have adopted dozens and dozens of ideas and causes fought for by socialists over the years. Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, is running for president, as you know, as a Democratic socialist, and he's been drawing big crowds lately for this populist, class-conscious message. And all of this is giving us an opportunity to talk about the history of socialism in the U.S. today, examine what it is exactly, and also talking about the contribution it's already made to American life. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have your own comments or questions about socialism, here are a few to think about. What does socialism mean to you? If a politician calls him or herself a socialist, does that change the way you think about them? Would you vote for a socialist? Would you support certain aspects of a socialist platform? 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Michael Kazin is joining us throughout the hour today. He's a professor of history at Georgetown University in Washington. He's also a co-editor of Dissent, that's a left-wing political magazine. He's the author of a number of books. Among them is his latest called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. And Michael Kazin is joining us today from the studios there on the Georgetown campus in Washington. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I actually wanted to begin with Dr. Seuss because I liked how you you began your latest book anyway with sort of the story of Dr. Seuss, or at least his role in the American left. And this is why I wanted to begin there. It's because you describe Dr. Seuss as an underappreciated accomplishment of the American left. And it seems like, and this is maybe a theme that we'll get to as we go along, but people on the left in this country, anyway, have never had much success in getting power. You've pointed this out. But you say they have played, you know, really this remarkable role in transforming, and this is how you put it in the book, the moral culture of the country. Talk about Dr. Seuss and where he sits in that scheme, the fact that they've never been good at getting power but had a powerful influence on the culture.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I should say I'm not sure Dr. Seuss ever called himself a socialist.
Right, right.
Though he certainly hung out with a lot of socialists. Yeah. And the book is about radicals more generally as well as about socialists. But you know, one of the things Dr. Seuss did, and I sort of realized this in almost an embryo. My mother used to read me the books when I was about 2 years old, beginning to, before I could read them for myself, was he really did a lot of books, especially in 1940s and 1950s, that were about what was wrong in American society, what was wrong in human society, whether it was racism with the Sneetches or authoritarian bosses and governments, as in I'm forgetting the name of it, Yertle the Turtle.
Yeah, yeah.
Horton Hears a Who was in many ways a parable of a people not caring about the poor and so on. And So one of the things he did in his books, I think, is, again, unappreciated except by historians who study him and biographers, is he was trying, I think, to translate the ideals of the broader left, including socialists, into very common language that even a 4-year-old, even a 2-year-old in many ways could understand.
Yeah. And this idea that but in the sense that it's had an impact on the moral culture of this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that leftists in general and socialists in particular have done throughout American history is, beginning really with the early 19th century, is they say to Americans, we have these wonderful ideals in America, equality, liberty, democracy, but in many ways they're not practiced. Or if they're practiced, they're practiced only for a minority or only for white people, only for men. And socialists have always said, if these ideals mean something, they should be practiced by everybody and equally by everybody. Mm-hmm. And there shouldn't be any privileged classes who have more liberty than other people, who have more resources than other people, who have more access to power than other people. I think that really is what, at their best, and there have been many bad moments in the history of the American left, at their best, American leftists, I think, have done that. And so even though, as you said in your intro, they have not been able to have political power except here and there, a mayor of a city, a few congresspeople, they have nevertheless, I think, helped to change how people think about the country, helped to put out, if you will, dreams that Americans should pursue.
They've had a powerful effect, you say, on what you call the common sense of society. Talk a little bit about that. This is essentially how Americans basically understand what's just and what is unjust. That seems important part.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an example, a very example, much of the news today is much of the news for many years, of course, which is the Black Freedom Movement.
Yeah.
The modern Black Freedom Movement, one can begin it in many places, but most people would begin it somewhere in World War II in the 1950s. And a lot of the people who were those who helped to birth that movement, people like Julian Bond, who, of course, died yesterday, Martin Luther King Jr., a Swedish academic, Gunnar Myrdal, who wrote the book about the gap between American ideals and American realities in terms of race, Michael Harrington, A. Philip Randolph, who was the inspiration for the March on Washington in 1963. All these people were radicals, and most of them actually called themselves socialists, including Martin Luther King Jr. Yeah. privately. But it's very clear to anybody who knew him that he was very sympathetic with the kind of society that was developing in Sweden and Denmark, the social democratic societies of Northern and Western Europe. So the Black Freedom Movement, though, of course, it was about the freedom for people of one race, was beyond that a movement for equality and democracy in a greater sense for all Americans. Mm. And it was radicals and socialists among them who really were some of the primary movers of that movement when it really started going.
Why do you figure, and I'm sure this is a complicated question as well as a complicated answer, but why do you figure that Americans have been willing over the decades to adopt the principles of the left, the principles of socialism, and yet not give socialists political power? What's been the disconnect, do you figure?
It's a complicated answer. Of course, all historians will tell you that big questions have complicated answers. But just to mention a few things. First of all, socialism, even the word has a foreign ring to it, I think. Mm. The first socialists were Europeans. They were French. They were British, German. And, you know, Americans traditionally like Americanism. Americanism, even for a lot of Americans on the left, is enough for them. They don't need a foreign ideology, even though Americanism, you could argue, has certain ideas in it that are quite friendly to socialism, like equality. And so I think when a lot of socialists themselves said, well, America is an okay country, but it'd be better if we adopted ideas from elsewhere. And so Americans who think America is the greatest country in the world have not wanted to adopt ideas from elsewhere. And the largest socialist parties in the world, before the Bolshevik Revolution, the largest socialist parties were all in Europe, the German Socialist Party, the British Labor Party, and others. So that's part of the reason. I think part of it, too, and I talk about this in my book, American Dreamers, is that Socialism in America, really around the world, when it's democratic socialism, not tyrannical socialism, stands for two different goals, I think. One is the greatest individual freedom and liberty as possible in speech, in writing, without regard to gender or race or ethnic group. The other is social equality. That is that the goods of society should be shared as equally as possible. People should work together to produce for the common good. And America is and has always been a very capitalist country. And I think that is the second ideal, that is social equality, is something that Americans who are grudgingly or enthusiastically willing to adopt ideals of racial equality and gender equality and not be anti-Semitic, not be anti-Catholic, which a lot of Americans were earlier in our history, or anti-Mormon for that matter, have a hard time saying, oh, but we should own the factories in common, the land. No one should own the land. It should be used by everybody as equally as possible. That has always been a step too far for most Americans.
Right. What do we mean by socialism? Let's get pretty elemental here for just a moment. And what's the difference between socialism, say, and communism?
Well, socialism comes from a Latin word, which basically means holding in common, society. And that original meaning of society was people together, a collectivity. And so the original meaning of socialism, which, by the way, began – it was a term before Marx. The term was coined when Marx was 7 years old. So
wow.
It was coined by Saint-Simon, a utopian socialist of France, and it was popularized in English by Robert Owen, a factory owner who was a socialist from Great Britain. Really what it meant was, as I said before, that the world would be better off. Human beings would live more harmoniously, more democratically, more peacefully if there was not competition to see who would get on top, to see who would have the most land, the most property, the most money, but if everyone cooperated. Basically, it meant a cooperative society, and that's the original meaning of it. And still, most people call themselves socialists today would still subscribe to that meaning, I think. Communism used to be in the 19th century, not so different from socialism, sort of meant socialists in a hurry. the Communist Manifesto, which Marx and Engels wrote, of course, in 1848, was adopted by socialists as easily as people called themselves communists. And the terms were used sometimes by the same people to mean the same thing. When the difference comes is when Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin and the other Bolsheviks make the revolution in Russia in the fall of 1917, and then they want to differentiate themselves from other socialists, people who wanted to continue to have democratic elections, for example, people who continued to believe there perhaps was some possibility of a common ground between a free market society and socialist programs. Lenin and Trotsky, who were the leaders of the Russian Revolution at the beginning at least, said, no, we have to have a communist party, a communist society. We have to do away with private property as totally as possible. And so they want to differentiate themselves from the more moderate socialists. So they founded a group called the Communist International, or the Comintern, to differentiate itself from an existing Socialist International. And so from 1917, 1918 on, there's been this pretty stark difference between communists and socialists, at least in the terminology.
Right. When does socialism first start to take hold a bit? Give us the sense of the early origins in the United States.
Well, really, the first socialists founded what they called, sounds very quaint, socialisms. And a socialism was a little socialist colony, we'd now think of it as, on the land. Yeah. There was one, a famous one outside Boston called Brook Farm, which Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote a scathing critique of called the Blithedale Romance after he spent several weeks there. There were several in other places in the country as well. And the idea there was to show people that socialism could work, that people could from different social backgrounds and sometimes different races too, though that was much more rare, could work the land together, could develop a handicraft industry together, sometimes could raise their children together, In some ways, it was like an Israeli kibbutz, at least in the early days of the Israeli kibbutzes. And the Israeli kibbutzes were socialist colonies in themselves, though they weren't called that. And really, that's how socialism began. In fact, Robert Owen, this industrialist who was from Great Britain, from Scotland actually, who ran a sort of model factory where he gave the workers a lot of power to decide what happened in the factory, comes over to the United States in 1825, and his ideas of sort of getting beyond capitalism, which was just developing, at least industrial capitalism in this country at the time, he speaks to a joint session of the Houses of Congress. And the President of the United States, John Quincy Adams, a new President of the United States, just elected in 1824, actually comes by to listen for a few minutes to Owen's speech. So even though most Americans think socialism is un-American, one of the first socialists in the world almost 200 years ago spoke to a joint session of Congress and got applause for doing so.
So it one thing that's interesting, I think, when you start talking about the rising movement in the left anyway, we get to the 20th century, the first part of the 20th century, and socialism, you write about, wasn't a fringe. I mean, and maybe it was in the scheme of things, but the party had, I think you've mentioned, like 100,000 members, which seemed significant for the time, ran thousands of candidates for all kinds of different offices around the country.
Yes, it was the only time socialism was really a broad-based movement in this country as such was in the first 20 years of the 20th century, when there was a group called the Socialist Party of America, SPA, and it had charismatic leaders like Eugene Debs, who ran for president five times as a socialist. It, as you say, there were mayors of hundreds of cities, mostly small ones. A place like Antlers, Oklahoma, out there in the plains in Oklahoma, had a socialist mayor for a while. Berkeley, California, perhaps less surprisingly, had a socialist mayor, though he was a Christian minister, Presbyterian, a guy named J. Stitt Wilson. And socialism at that time managed to break into what you might call mainstream America. There were lots of socialist farmers in Oklahoma. There were socialist miners in Utah and Colorado. There were a lot of socialists in the suffrage movement. As you mentioned, the Socialist Party was the first political party in America to support women's suffrage, long before the Democrats and Republicans did. And so you had this heterogeneous organization. It wasn't huge. 100,000 members was not as big as, say, the Democratic and Republican parties, of course. Sure. But they were able to make arguments to millions of Americans in a way socialists, perhaps until Bernie Sanders, were not able to make. And the leader of the Socialist Party, Eugene Debs, their major candidate for president, was one of the most popular orators in America when oratory was an entertainment, something people would go to hear a speech of an hour, 2 hours long, because they knew the orator would not just be eloquent but have something important to say. And even though Debs never got more than 6% of the vote in a presidential election, that in 1912, a lot of people came to see him and could have liked what he said but then didn't want to waste their vote, you know, on a third party. And I should say, a lot of people listening are obviously from Utah. Debs got more votes disproportionately in Utah than in many other states. In 1912, he got 8% of the vote in Utah, though, of course, Utah had a very small population at the time.
Which brings up a question that comes from AE, writes this email about, he says, I'm hoping you'll refer to or mention at least one instance of Utah's uneasy history with socialism. Part of his crime was that Joe Hill was a socialist.
Yep.
Yeah. So yep. Joe, that was that was right around that time that you're mentioning, that there was a lot of
1915, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. He was actually probably an anarchist rather than a socialist. Right. We can talk about the differences.
Yeah.
But he was a member. He was a member of this radical union called the Industrial Workers of the World,
the
many of whom's members were socialists. And yes, he was executed for supposedly killing a grocer in Salt Lake, I think. And of course, later on, people like Joan Baez sing this famous song about him, about Joe Hill dying, a song which is actually written by a socialist, or actually a member of the Communist Party named Earl Robinson. But communists also consider themselves to be socialists, as I said before.
Did you get a sense that Was there ever a time, and I'm wondering if right around this particular time, did you ever get a sense that the socialism, if something hadn't happened, if it hadn't gone this way, or if it hadn't been perceived as being too radical or too exotic, you know, too foreign, was there ever a time when it, like, it could have caught on in this country in a larger way to, you know, more of the rank and file, more mainstream Americans?
That's a great question. You know, historians love to talk about counterfactuals of this kind. What if Eleanor Roosevelt could fly? I remember one from Saturday Night Live several years ago. One of the geniuses of American politics, perhaps, which has always frustrated socialists, is that major parties in the 20th century, mostly the Democratic Party, have often taken over ideas from socialists,
right,
like the income tax, like Social Security, like industrial unionism and supporting industrial unionism. So socialists historically always stand for what they call immediate demands, things like a graduate income tax, things like higher tax on corporations, things like votes for women, doing away with Jim Crow laws. But what they really want is a worker and popularly controlled society. Well, American political parties are, because we only have two of them, and they're very large and usually rather heterogeneous parties themselves, smart politicians, Democrats in the 20th century, sometimes Republicans in the 19th century, took over some of the issues that socialists were pushing, some of their immediate demands, and made them part of their platform. Mm-hmm. And so they people felt, even if they were – even people – members of the Socialist Party sometimes in the 20th century said, well, I might as well vote for Franklin D. Roosevelt because I like what he's saying. He's adopted some of our ideas. If I vote for Norman Thomas, who was then the leader of the Socialist Party, who was running for president against Roosevelt, mm-hmm, then the Republicans might win. And I know I want Franklin Roosevelt much more than I want the Republican to win, so I'll vote for Roosevelt instead. And over time, the fact that the Democratic Party was allied with the unions – unions had always been socialists had always been very overrepresented in the unions, often controlled major unions for a time. That made it difficult, I think, for socialists to really get very far. And whereas in Europe, you had political parties that for a long time in many countries didn't allow working people to vote. You had to have property to vote. And so the socialists began really to demand the right to vote for everybody. And it was a long time before the so-called bourgeois parties took over that demand. And so the socialists were able to get themselves established as the party of working people who had no political rights.
We'll come back to this actually a little bit later in the program when we talk a little bit more about Bernie Sanders in particular, his campaign anyway. But this does seem to be, at least for a lot of observers, where Bernie Sanders is right now, getting big crowds. People have a deep kind of affection for him, and a lot of Democrats in particular, certainly progressives, are very much his message is appealing to them, but the question of whether they could vote for him or would vote for him or what effect that may have in the scheme of things seems to be the thing that may hold them back. So it seems like nothing's really changed in that way.
Yeah, in a sense you're right that Bernie Sanders is doing what socialists have always done really and quite successfully often, that is get people talking about their issues, not necessarily voting for them, beginning they're talking about their issues, like a $15 minimum wage for everybody in the country, mm-hmm, like expanding Social Security instead of cutting it back the way a lot of Republicans want to do, like having a serious discussion about decriminalizing drug possession and things like that, and also about the way in which this American society has become much more unequal, right, economically in the last 40 years, even though a lot of advances have been made in terms of rights for LGBT people and women and also, African Americans and other racial minorities. Socialists, the bottom line for socialists has always been we need a more economically, socially equal society. And he's talking about that in no uncertain terms. But as you say, he's unlikely to get the nomination of the Democratic Party, much less to win the presidential election if he got the nomination, because America hasn't changed that much.
Right.
For President Bernie Sanders to happen, we'd have to be a different country.
One thing along this line, you've written about there was this sort of insurgent political party called the People's Party in the early 20th century. It rises up for a time and it raises these issues that you've been mentioning, you know, labor organizing and the progressive income tax. But then, as you say, you know, eventually the Democrats just adopt those issues. And I wondered, that seems like a theme with socialists, is that, as you say, other parties sort of take their causes, co-opt their some of their principles. So does it really matter then for socialists if they actually achieve power? As long as people are talking about their issues, maybe that's all that matters.
Sure. Well, talking about an issue is great, but doing something about it is a different matter.
Right.
Marx's favorite phrase, or one of his famous phrases, philosophers will only interpret the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. And politicians will talk about a lot of things. But the point, of course, is to have a movement which can elect people who actually get those things done. And that happened in Europe. It happened in Scandinavia, happened in France, happened in Germany, happened to a degree in Great Britain and Italy as well, Netherlands, some other countries too, Japan to a certain degree as well. And so it took a socialist party to be pretty strong in those countries, sometimes to run the country, sometimes not to run them, but to be the second largest party, which is true right now in Germany, by the way. And so in this country, because the socialists have never had much power politically, it's much easier for politicians from the Democratic Republican parties to listen to people with a lot of power who are very much against a lot of those ideas socialists are for, like the Koch brothers, like many other people, Sheldon Adelson and others. And so what Bernie Sanders talks about, that we have a country run by billionaires, perhaps that's a little too simplistic, but certainly billionaires have a lot more power over public policy than ordinary working people do. And that's one of the things which is less true in countries where socialist parties have been more powerful and more successful.
Michael Kazin is with us. He's a professor of history at Georgetown University. His latest book is called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about socialism. A lot of us have a kind of vague idea of what that means. And we have known, of course, that it hasn't really taken hold in this country. But we're talking about why, talking about the history of socialism in the U.S., examining what it is, and also talking about the contribution it's already made in American life. Michael Kazin is with us. He's written a book called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. He's a professor of history at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He's joining us from the campus there. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. I think one of the impressions you get about socialism is that it was a social economic experiment that was proposed, been tried in various places, and failed. It didn't work. The journalist Matthew Continetti, editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, he says that old-school socialism failed to achieve its goals, which is to say, you know, the equal distribution of wealth, a classless society. He also makes another point I want to come back to, but to his point that, and I think this is an impression of a lot of mainstream Americans, it was a noble, grand idea, but it didn't play out, couldn't work in practice.
Well, I think that's true in societies like Russia and China, Vietnam, Cuba, where a communist party controlled the whole economy and tried to get everyone, in a sense, working for the state and criminalized anybody, you know, working for themselves. I think that's true. I mean, I think you have to have room for entrepreneurs. You have to have a price mechanism based on supply and demand to a certain extent at least. So these sort of command economies, as it used to be called, with five-year plans and sometimes, you know, quite brutal administrations, those certainly did not work. Now, what a democratic socialist like I am would say is, first of all, those societies were those tyrannical socialist economies were located in poor countries, not in industrial countries, not in countries where people were very well educated for the most part, at least with lower classes not very well educated. And so industrialization was undertaken brutally, very quickly in many cases. And, of course, now we look at China and we say, my God, they've come a long way. But, of course, they've come a long way led by a communist slash socialist party, which has allowed capitalism to flourish, to at least to some extent. But where I think socialism has worked, and I mentioned this before the break, is in countries in Western Europe, Southern Europe to a degree, some parts of Latin America, like Argentina, Brazil to an extent, Japan, where there have been they have what are called mixed economies, where you have some government-controlled industries, a lot of government investment, often in private industries as well, and where there's a welfare state, where people, poor people, there are many fewer poor people than there are in this country. People are well-educated for the most part. Public school teachers are paid better. In other words, where we have the technical term is really social democracies as opposed to socialism, because there's a mixture of capitalism and socialism. There, I think, having the best of socialism, if you will, the more democratic, more liberated parts of socialism, and the best parts of capitalism, that is, giving people a chance to make something of themselves other than what the state might want them to be, I think there you can argue that socialism has worked. But socialism in Soviet Union and in Maoist China did not work.
Yeah. Well, Continetti, the other point he makes is that the left, he says, has made a kind of truce with capitalism. The focus more today is on cultural issues than economic issues. And I think that's something that you've been concerned about on the left, that while there is absolutely nothing wrong, and it's critical, of course, that the left has supported equal rights for people of color, equal rights for the LGBT community. In some ways, they've maybe set aside or neglected the issues of economic justice.
I think that that was true to some extent, though certainly people in labor unions have never done that.
Right.
People, community organizers like Barack Obama, when he used to be a community organizer, were not doing that. But I think since the Great Recession began and ended, but of course a lot of people still think it's on, and it still feels like it's on in their lives anyway, that has not been true at all. I mean, Occupy Wall Street, even though it was really more of an uprising than it was a movement, nevertheless helped to infuse, helped to inject the language of class, the language of economic inequality into American political dialogue in a way it probably had not been in a mainstream way for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I think since then you have a lot of politicians, sometimes conservative ones as well, but certainly liberal ones, and almost all Democrats talking about those issues again. You have some activity around it, around $15 an hour minimum wage efforts among fast food workers. Several liberal cities like Seattle, Los Angeles have adopted that wage. So I think at Bernie Sanders' campaign itself, I think, is a very good sign that a lot of mostly white liberals, who are the ones who are flocking to his rallies for the most part, this issue is as important for them now as issues of gender equality, racial equality, same-sex marriage, and so forth. So I think that's not true anymore. I don't know when Continetti wrote that, but I'd say since 2008, 2009, that's not been true.
801-585-WEST is a number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Virginia is joining us in Salt Lake City. Virginia, hi.
Hi. Professor Kaysen, my question is, with U.S. democracy facing an existential crisis as the result of the Supreme Court's disastrous 2010 Citizens United decision, have not American voters come to the point of ending the capitalist maxim to privatize profits and socialize costs?
Good question. I'm sorry I didn't mention Citizens United and, of course, the way the freedom that people with a lot of money have to basically float a candidate and dominate campaign contributions in this country. I think it's a serious problem. Of course, as you see with Sanders today, it's quite possible to run a pretty serious campaign for nomination of one of the major parties without having a lot of money, because you do have the media, both media like this one and all the other media we know about catch on to you. So it's not impossible, but I think certainly it would be wonderful if we had socialists or other people in American politics who were really made changing in a serious way the campaign finance system a priority for them. The problem, I'm afraid, and this goes to one of the problems that socialists have always had, I think Americans are rather cynical about money and politics. I think most Americans believe, and you see this in polls, unfortunately, perhaps, they think both parties are basically corrupt. Both parties are full of people who will do the bidding of rich people. So better vote for the candidate who is a little more or a lot more on your side on the issues, but it still might be bought off by the rich. And that's a problem because, some people, left-wing Democrats like Elizabeth Warren, like Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, and like Bernie Sanders himself, have said we need a constitutional amendment to overthrow, to do away with Citizens United, to have more something, some kind of small donor domination again of American politics. But of course, passing a constitutional amendment is almost as hard as it would be to institute a socialist economy in this country. Yeah. So that's unlikely to happen anytime soon. So we're stuck with the system we have. And pretty much all one can do, at least in the short run, I think, is to talk eloquently, strongly, with some policy ideas of how to lessen that influence.
Virginia, glad you joined us. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Another call from Patricia in Salt Lake City. Hi, welcome.
Hi. I'm going to make this quick. It kind of backs up. I'm sorry for that. I want to know if the Bolsheviks did their best to kill off socialists after they took power in Russia. And also, did Eugene Debs spend some years in prison at one time?
He ran for president from a prison cell, did he not, Michael Kazin?
Yes, in 1920 from the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary because he was jailed during World War I for giving a speech which opposed the war, which was illegal at that time under the Espionage Act. So he was, yes, he was. He spoke at a socialist picnic in Canton, Ohio, where the National Football Hall of Fame is located. in 1918, and he was arrested by the Bureau of Investigations, it was called at the time, and the Justice Department tried him, and he was put in jail, and he was finally released from jail after 3 years, pardoned by President Warren G. Harding. The first question, yes, the Bolsheviks, again, were originally socialists. They were part of the Social Democratic Party of Russia, which was the translation of that party's name. During the Russian Civil War, a very bloody civil war, killed 10 million people after the Bolsheviks took power. They're fighting to keep the revolution alive. They put those who were radicals as well as those who were conservatives in Russia often in jail for opposing their power. And afterwards, when the communists in the Soviet Union said, we can only have one party here, divisions will just help the fascists, help the counter-revolutionaries. Anybody who didn't convert to being a communist and wanted to stay politically active was in trouble. Not all of them were put in jail. Some of them just were not allowed to take part in public life.
Thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Michael Kazin with us. His book is... latest book, anyway, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Professor Michael Kazin. He's a professor of history at Georgetown. His latest book is called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So we're getting a few questions about Bernie Sanders, some practical ones about how it would work if he were elected, those kinds of things. But I wanted to maybe ask you just more generally, how has Bernie Sanders, do you think, changed the race so far, or even the political landscape? Because you've pointed out Hillary Clinton is speaking a lot more carefully about certain issues, economic equality in particular.
Yes, as a lot of people have said, I think the base of the Democratic Party has moved to the left since the Great Recession. I think partly having Barack Obama president helped that, not that Barack Obama is a socialist, as some conservatives seem to think, but he's a liberal Democrat. And when liberal Democrats are in power, that helps, I think, to popularize a lot of the things they talk about, even if they don't carry through on them. And, of course, the recession, as I mentioned, has had a big impact, too. So people who are disappointed to a certain degree with some of the things Obama has not done that he promised to do, like make it easier for unions to organize, have, I think, given Bernie Sanders some talking points, given him a base that he might have not had before outside of Vermont. And Hillary Clinton, who's a politician, obviously, has to respond to that. She doesn't want to lose a primary. She wants people who are now supporting Bernie Sanders when, as I think she probably will, get the nomination, she wants them working for her and getting the vote out for her. So that's what politicians have always done, of course. They respond to public opinion to the extent that they feel they have to. And sometimes they do it because they want to. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really what's happened. And, of course, not to say it's only people who want more powerful unions. Of course, Black Lives Matter has had a huge impact in the last couple of years, last year and a half, especially since what happened in Ferguson happened. And so there, too, there's been pressure both on Sanders and also on Hillary Clinton to have a stronger message about racial equality and about the treatment of African Americans by the police. And, of course, beyond that is an economic message, too, because part of people who live in upper middle class black communities don't get treated the same way by the police as they do living in poor black communities like some of the ones in Baltimore or here in Anacostia in Washington, D.C. So that's also – there's an economic side to the Ferguson, to the Black Lives Matter movement as well. So, you know, Bernie Sanders will perhaps the best he can do, I think, predicting the people who I know who – or working on his campaign, probably wouldn't like me saying this, I think he can be a powerful catalyst for what happens in the election next year, even if he doesn't get the nomination.
Here's a comment from Jim who writes, how does socialism deal with the lazy, rich, and poor? If they don't want to do their part but reap the benefits of the social programs, wouldn't that continue to produce a society that's unmotivated to work and to produce? And this personifies one of the central arguments against what some people perceive the idea of socialism as, you know, as an economic mechanism, that it lacks incentive, that it that the free market, you have to have skin in the game in order to participate. And so this is one of those. I wanted to get you to respond to that.
No, I mean, that's obviously been one of the most powerful arguments that's always raised against socialism, that it does away with individual initiative, that people will get fed and get clothed and get housed and get helped in their old age, whether or not they work or not. And that's one of the reasons why you had the evolution from socialists believing that all human beings will work because they just want, you know, to work for the common good, to believing that everyone should work and that people should be well paid when they work hard, that they should be able to organize unions when they work hard, but they, you know, should not be able to live on the dole, except for a period after they get unemployed before they find a new job. I mean, but that really is what you have in the social democratic societies, the ones I mentioned, that have, at least until very recently, because of the recession over in Europe, have done pretty well, I think. And unemployment rates are very low over there, actually. I mean, certainly everyone – and, you know, socialists, even in what I call tyrannical socialist societies like China and the Soviet Union – people couldn't just sit around. They were forced to work. They had to find jobs. There was no unemployment by design. Even if you had to sweep the streets, the same street twice in the same day, you had to make sure that you were working. So I think in reality, as opposed to the reputation, if you will, of socialism, that really has not been a serious problem.
One of the things you've written about is this, and this was a few years ago you talked about, and so your response may be different now, but one of the things you talked about a few years ago, this was actually before the 2012 election, you said one of the keys for the left trying to change the balance of power right now is to redefine the old ideal of economic justice. Has that changed? As you said, that obviously is the thing, that idea of economic justice is the component of Bernie Sanders' campaign that seems to be resonating with a lot of people. Occupy Wall Street, another number of these movements are emerging. So are we sort of there? Is the left moving there, if not there already, reestablishing those old ideals of economic justice?
It's trying to. It's a tough road. I mean, I didn't know I said we had to redefine them. I guess rearticulate them in better ways. I should have redefined my own language there, I think. But I think, as I said before, there's a problem that the left has always had in this country that it seems as if your previous caller mentioned that, a previous emailer that you read from mentioned this, that there's always been a problem that the left has seemed to stand for people who don't want to help themselves, who just want to get help by other people. And that's a real problem, again, ideologically, because, people on the left I know, some of the hardest working people around, you know, they work for very little money on my magazine and other left-wing institutions, often 10, 12, 14 hours a day to try to change society, to do away with the injustices that they see. But on the other hand, obviously a lot of people who make – Jeff Bezos from Amazon works very hard too. So the left has no premium on that. But I think there's a certain – what the left has to say, and I think what Americans should say, leftist or not, is that there's something indecent about having – almost 20% of Americans living in poverty. There's something indecent about knowing that the globe is warming. We have all these serious climate problems, and because some people make money on oil and coal, we don't want to do anything about it. There's something indecent about people being killed because they have their own religion. I mean, things the socialists have always talked about, continue to talk about, which are of course continue to be serious problems. And I think, for me, a moral language is something that people on the left should use more. Many times they are leery of using that language, but I think it's important to talk in moral terms, whether you're a religious person or not a religious person, because in the end, I think most people want everyone to have enough, to have creative work, to have the freedom to speak their mind. And we don't have that in this country now, and we don't have that in the world. And that's something that socialists have always stood for.
I wonder if you think that one of the things you've written about is that the left needs – I mean, you talk about how the right was very successful at establishing these institutions that helped keep them in power but also keep them in sort of the public discourse. I mean, talk radio and lobbyists and all of these – they had this kind of infrastructure that they were really good at establishing. You've talked about the fact that the left really needs to learn to fashion their own kinds of institutions and infrastructure. Are they figuring it out? Are they getting those? Or is that been difficult for the left?
I think it's been difficult. I mean, part of the problem, of course, is that people on the right have more money for the most part, not always entirely. The people in Hollywood have a lot of money, for example. There are some left-wing hedge fund millionaires, though not very many. They're more liberal than left-wing. But it's a problem with my magazine. I'm always telling people, look, we have a very good magazine. We have a great website, Dissent, that is. But our budget is tiny, about $250,000 a year. And right-wing magazines have no problem raising money. So I think in many ways the left perhaps in this country has depended on government too much to do for its ideals what conservatives who believe that government should be, of course, less powerful do with their own institutions, like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Foundation, Cato Institute, rather, mm-hmm. and many others. So I think part of the problem because people on the left believe in public services, believe in the public interest, believe in government serving the public, often they don't feel like they need their own institutions in the same way. And labor unions, which used to be, I would argue, the most powerful left institution in American life, mm-hmm. as you know, have declined for many reasons, some their own fault and most not their own fault, I think, over the last 40, 50 years. And that's been a real problem for the economic left because people in trade unions, labor unions, tended to get an education about the way the economy works and the way politics works in a way that working people now, you know, maybe they get it from Rush Limbaugh, maybe they get it from Fox TV, maybe they don't get it at all.
There are a few questions about coming back to Bernie Sanders here, whether or not he could play the role of a spoiler, whether he would consider a third-party candidacy. Ryan writes, is there an historical context for party loyalty for socialists? Because one of the biggest complaints about Bernie Sanders, Ryan writes anyway, is that he and his supporters are not loyal to the Democrats. You want to say something about that?
Sure. Well, we talked earlier about the time many years ago now, almost a century ago, when there was a serious socialist party in this country which could elect its own people. But, of course, that hasn't been true for many, many years. Not in my lifetime, and I'm 67, so certainly not for a long time. And so Bernie Sanders, of course, is elected as an independent in Vermont, and then he's running as a Democrat because he doesn't want to be a spoiler. He's made it very clear he's not going to run a third-party campaign the way Ralph Nader did in 2000,
right.
Which one could argue handed the election, at least in Florida, to George W. Bush, which, of course, was the key state in that election 15 years ago. But at the same time, he wants to retain a separate identity, which is his right, and wants to make sure that that he is not just another Democrat in the Senate, but he has a certain special status, which I think probably gets him more attention, perhaps, than it would if he was just another Democrat. But he's not going to form his own party anytime soon or probably ever because he understands the zero-sum contest that American politics is, especially at the presidential level.
That's historian Michael Kazin. His latest book is called American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. He joined us from the campus of Georgetown University. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks very much, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.